to CJLO 1690 AM dans Montréal, Québec.
For CJLO News, I'm Tana Nijimbere. L'équipe multisectorielle dédiée aux armes à feu arrested two people by the name of Tavon Nesfield, age 30, and Aviana Thompson, age 20, this Thursday. They were arrested on charges of extortion and racketeering against local restaurants. Nesfield was arrested for alleged extortion against the Maui restaurant committed on July 5th and September 12th. His co-accused Thompson is being charged for allegedly firing a weapon at the Sushi Hidden Fish restaurant between August 25th and 26th. The police proceeded with their arrest after searching multiple homes. According to court documents, the value of the property damage is over $5,000. This is one of the many arrests for extortion of restaurants in Montreal recently. Kenya's deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua, has been removed from office. He was impeached by the Senate this Thursday. Rigathi Gachagua faced 11 charges for insubordination to the president, inciting ethnic violence, corruption, undermining government, money laundering, and more. These charges were formed after Gachagua's falling out with Kenyan President Ruto. This led to critics accusing Gachagua for inciting anti-government protests in July and June of this year. The former deputy president and the National Assembly both argued their cases this Thursday. The Senate found him guilty of 5 of the 11 charges that he faced. He was cleared of 6 charges, including a corruption charge. Gachagua is the first deputy president to be impeached since impeachment was introduced in the Kenyan 2010 constitution. On October 16th, the Ministry of Public Health in Lebanon confirmed a case of cholera. This case is the first detected since June 2023. It was identified in a car governorate in the north of Lebanon. Cholera is a bacterial disease typically spread through contaminated water. Its symptoms are severe diarrhea and dehydration. If left untreated, it can be fatal within hours, even for those who are in good health. In response, the World Health Organization has activated a cholera preparedness and response plan to enhance surveillance and contact tracing, including environmental surveillance and water sampling. They aim to also support infection prevention and control measures in designated treatment center facilities. The outbreak poses a direct threat to Lebanon's health infrastructure, which is already overburdened by a wave of injuries resulting from the Israeli invasion in the south of the country. Okay. For more, go to cjlo.com/news and follow CJLO News on Spotify.
Hello. This is The Get Up, and you're listening to CJLO 1690. My name's Hannah, and today I'm here with a Montreal-based filmmaker. She's directed many short films in the horror, comedy, and horror comedy combined genres, and most recently, a feature film that I'm excited to talk to her about. Welcome, Kay Adelaide.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So I first came into contact with your films last month in September at the Exposures Film Festival, which was, I was there for a student newspaper, but was just a great introduction to like so many great films by trans and gender diverse filmmakers out of Montreal and abroad. And two of your short films were shown there. And yeah, I guess, do you want to talk a little bit about what kind of movies you make?
Sure. Yeah. That was a lot of fun at the Exposures Trans Film Festival. I got to show off a couple of things that I made, which it's always stuff that's got like something fantastic about it. Something like outside of reality, a bit like elevated and out there, but then keeping it fun, keeping it light, trying to just be playful. You know, I think the best art doesn't take itself too seriously for the most part, because life is serious enough. Like, why can't art be enjoyable while you're experiencing it? Yeah,
absolutely. Don't Text Back, I saw yesterday, and I just really love all the laughs. I feel like throughout it is spooky and it touches on witchcraft and curses, but there's also just like, I feel like you're having fun with the Montreal tropes, with the kind of quip at veganism and the other quips about just like heteronormative dating cycles.
Yeah.
And commentary on dating apps as well. Yeah, I guess. How did you get into wanting to make horror?
I think it started from a young age of sort of being really afraid of fantastical stuff in movies, like just getting really freaked out by Large Marge and Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the scary face that happens there, that like traumatized me, and I like had to find out how special effects work just to reassure myself that like things as scary as you can see in the movies don't exist in reality, kind of. So I needed to like see how it was a constructed fake thing, and I was like making fake blood at like 5 years old, you know. So it was all to sort of like reassure myself that the things you're seeing on screen can be faked. You're not seeing people actually die, you're not seeing things actually that scary. And yeah, that just kind of always stuck around, and it to me seemed like a really normal thing. When I started to get into filmmaking in like my tween years, I was always doing all my own special effects, and it always had like a horror angle, you know. That was like during the big zombie wave of the early aughts. Like it all just seemed very natural and normal part of filmmaking. And it wasn't until I got to film school that I realized not everyone's into genre, not everyone does their own special effects and all these sort of things.
Yeah, I really liked that, looking at the credits, seeing that on your feature film, that you were so involved in those aspects of it too. So for you, doing special effects on the feature, is that... in part, I know you love it, but is it also because of budget constraints? Or do you think that, like, as you go forward in filmmaking, you're going to stay with the special effects as well as directing and writing?
Yeah, I mean, I really do love practical special effects, and I'm really passionate about it. I feel that, you know, there's a lot of different art forms rolled into filmmaking. It's not just one thing. There's the whole art department is what they call art, but there's also, you know, so many other forms of art. And for me, I feel that the special effects aspect is very much sculptural. And I really like making sculptures. I have a background in some sculpture that I like studied here at Concordia, actually. And so I feel that that's sort of a way to incorporate my like expression in the sculptural realm into my film is to do it that through the special effects. And I mean, I think at some point I might come to a place where I'm making a larger film with so many special effects that I won't be able to sort of get my hands dirty with it as much as I do currently. But at that point, I think I'd still want to be a director who's very involved with every step of it and sort of keeping an eye on it and everything. Whereas I think some directors do sort of take a more hands-off approach and just wait till they get to set and be like, oh, what does it look like now that we're here on set? Oh, that doesn't look quite right. Well, too late now. You know, I definitely never want to let that be the case.
That's a really great point. I didn't know you had a background in sculpture, but I had meant to ask, because in your short film Monster Dyke, of course, the clay sculpture is such a big part of the film. Yeah, I think it's a really great point of... like that you're in multiple disciplines as an artist. And I really love that. And I appreciate when I was working in visual effects, when it was clear that the director really kind of had a passion and had a vision specifically for those effects. Because I feel like, well, one, it made everyone's life easier on the visual effects side, but just of it being part of their like full vision, and how much fun that is for like anything that has monsters, especially, is something I love. But also I know in the rebrand, it's, you know, not a monster movie per se. And I just thought the effects like really added to it. And I don't think that they crossed the line into camp, as much as I love camp, but it didn't seem like that wasn't really the tone you were going for, right, in the rebrand.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tone kind of evolved itself pretty naturally. And I think in some of the performances and maybe the like makeup on the character Thistle, who's this like really out there influencer, really done up with like crazy lip liner and highlighter on her cheeks and everything, like, I feel like that's got like a camp element, but then I think the effects are maybe a bit more grounded in like horror than being sort of straight up campy. So yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoyed watching it. I have to say, going back to Monsters, I'm a little bit of a chicken. I love a zombie movie. I love a monster movie. But the other classic horror movies I've seen because I had to for a horror movie class I was in. So it was a great way to kind of like force myself because I think I was missing out on the genre because I'm not someone who would voluntarily go see, oh my gosh, The Ring, that's aging me. But whatever new movie, Smile 2 or whatever is out today, like I just makes me so nervous, the idea of going to see that in theaters. But I thought it was, I was on the edge of my seat, but it was really enjoyable. And it was also like cut with the humor throughout.
Yes.
I think it would be great to play the clip we have of Thistle. Do you want to just maybe explain, just give a little bit of context to what's happening, or maybe we should talk a little bit just about the basis of the film first.
Totally. Yeah, sure. So the film, the rebrand, it's my first feature film, my first full length picture. And it's co-written with one of the stars, Nancy Webb, who is an absolute genius. And we sort of wrote it together as like an outline. And then the vast majority of the dialogue is actually improvised by Nancy and the other performers. And they're so brilliant. You know, there was such an incredible collaboration on set. The plot of the film is essentially that there are these two lesbian influencers who have been canceled, and they're trying to make a redemption documentary to sort of rebrand themselves as wholesome mommy influencers. And Thistle says that she's pregnant and they're going to have a baby. But to make this redemption documentary, they've hired a videographer who is 8 months pregnant herself, and they're kind of treating her very strangely from the beginning, and they end up kind of keeping her semi-hostage there to continue filming the movie for them. But it seems like there's some sort of very creepy ulterior motives going on throughout it all, and it gets pretty crazy by the end. I think of it in a way as sort of a slasher origin story, kind of.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Oh, the only thing I wanted to add is, so this is a clip of Thistle, the influencer who I feel like sort of embodies this like performative, like idolized feminism, feminist. Like,
femininity. And
thank like, you. Yeah. Yeah. And she wakes up the filmographer, Nicole, seemingly at 5 a.m.
Yes.
And we see the viewer sees Thistle in a full face of makeup and this like beautiful bridal outfit.
Yes, that's right. That's what we're going to hear.
Great.
This needs to be perfect. Have you ever shot a wedding?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So you know what to do. I think you might want to pop on some under eye cream because I'm seeing some little dark circles there. Do you need a pepperette? Can you be ready in 5 minutes? Amazing. I love you. You're so cute in the morning. It's like crazy. You're making me crazy. Like I want to marry you.
Yes. So that is Nancy Webb.
Yes, the genius Nancy
Your
Webb.
Your co-writer and one of the stars of the movie. I could just like from the beginning, I feel like the acting in this film is fantastic. Your dynamic that you clearly have with Nancy just really shows through because it just feels like I don't like the quality of acting out of like a big budget movie. Like I was just convinced.
They're so great. They're like everybody involved. Like I was expecting for it to be really funny. And I'd worked with Nancy before on Don't Text Back, which you're mentioning, like, and I knew she could be really funny. That film is more light and more just like pure comedy. There isn't any sort of dramatic moments, but I feel like in this film, like all the actors being asked to do more dramatic things, they just knocked that out of the park in a way that was like so beyond my wildest dreams of what they can do. It's so much talent on display. Yeah,
agreed. I think we're about to go on a quick break, but afterwards I would love to talk to you more about like the commentary on influencing culture in this movie.
Sounds so great.
It's that time of year again. CGLO's annual funding drive is taking place from October 11th to the 26th. And as always, we've got some exciting events planned over both weeks. So grab a pen and get ready to mark your calendars. Friday, October 25th, there'll be a special all-nighter broadcast from 9 p.m. to 9 a.m. featuring a rotating cast of CGLO DJs and special guests. So be sure to tune in at cjlo.com or 1690 AM. I'll be there and you're going to want to hear what we've cooked up, I swear. We hope to see you at some events. Stay tuned at 1690 AM or cjlo.com. And for more information about our funding drive, you can go to cjlofundingdrive.com.
Do you love hip-hop and R&B? Is your Thursday afternoon lacking groove? I'm DJ Samuel D. Roberts, and I got you covered. Listen to my show, Whip Appeal. I'll be playing hip-hop bangers, R&B slow jams, and everything in between from Canada and around the globe to groove up your Thursday afternoon. Listen to Whip Appeal, Thursdays at 2 p.m. CJLO 1690 AM.
CJL 1690 AM. Years of radioactivity.
All right, you're listening to CJLO 1690. This is The Get Up. My name is Hannah, and I'm here with Kay Adelaide, Montreal filmmaker. We are talking about her new feature film, The Rebrand. Just such a fun black comedy horror film. I know online, I think it said black comedy, but how do you, like, which genre, how do you describe it to people yourself, Kay?
I mean, we definitely use the word dark comedy a lot. I think the goal in making it was to do a found footage horror comedy. And I was a bit nervous if the horror comes through enough to call it a horror comedy or if it's just a dark comedy. But I mean, you were saying you're kind of on the edge of your seat a bit watching it, and I've been getting that feedback also. And the festivals it's played at have been billing it as a found footage horror comedy without me even suggesting that. So I'm like, okay, we made it there. That's awesome. That's what it comes out as. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So you were a little bit hesitant to label it as part of the horror genre because of that.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I think, I mean, it's so funny. There's so much humor all throughout. Like, any of the scary moments get cut by comedy. But to me, that's my favorite thing, is to, you're holding your breath from something scary and then you suddenly burst out laughing from something funny. That's like my absolute favorite sensation to evoke that film has such a power to do. And I think, you know, we had like early test screenings before we had like the music in place that adds a lot of like tension, where people were saying, oh, it feels more like a dark comedy than horror. So I was like, does it come through as horror? But it seems like it has at this point in the final version. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's also really interesting, you saying that you were running it as a test screening, someone who hasn't done that much filmmaking, but without the kind of suspenseful music. I think that is so key to any horror movie, right? Of like signaling to the viewer, like, you know, because also, yeah, I think you are like not too heavy-handed with like the
like the jump scare things.
Yeah, but also like kind of premonition of like from the beginning, like little bit of like hints of what's to happen. There's not too many of them. I know Blair says at one point, like, oh, there's cameras in every room. You know, you can't get in or out without...
Yeah. Nobody gets in, nobody gets out without us knowing.
Yeah. So there's that, but like, there isn't too many of those lines to kind of like, to warn the viewer. So yeah, I feel like it needs that music to kind of be like, oh, you know, and also talking about Nancy Webb again, like her performance is just like, I was spooked by her in the middle of like, oh my gosh, what is she gonna do? Because she's playing that sort of
deranged
kind of, yeah, like abusive partner so well. And I think that's the other thing that I was like spooked by of so many horror films, of like really talking about things that unfortunately people face in reality, of like, it's not just about the supernatural, right? It's about these, like, this person is just like really despicable.
I think it's really showing like the possible like extent of like a toxic queer dynamic that, you know, I think we can all sort of recognize, seeing like much like milder, non-scary, but just like annoying or frustrating versions of the dynamic that they have. And then this is just turned up to 11, just like completely over the top, like the worst the relationship could possibly go kind of thing, like examining like how twisted and unhealthy and abusive can a queer relationship get. And I think, yeah, there is something genuinely scary about that, because I think a lot of the time we think of abuse and these really unhealthy, toxic dynamics being more prevalent in hetero relationships. And I think statistically they are, but that doesn't mean that it can't happen in the world of queer relationships. It certainly can still happen and does.
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. And how those behaviors play out in, like, with Nancy Webb's character being a woman as well, of, like, well before there's any hint of a physical threat in the movie. I don't want to talk too much about it. I'm very anti-spoiler myself. But, yeah, I'm just talking about the manipulation tactics that I think are talked about more today, but just how, like, that's something that, you know, you don't have to be a cis man to perpetrate.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that in media, I think we're talking about that more of, like, I think at one point Thistle is saying to Blair, her partner, you were gaslighting me. But, like, it's, like, very meta of, like, she's gaslighting her partner, but using gaslighting as a term to do it, like, weaponizing it against her. But I think... And of course, I wanted to bring up as well, like, the layer of them being social media influencers. And at different points in the movie, we see that they're doing lives and sort of like playing for the camera. But of course, because it's this like found footage mockumentary, we're also seeing like the takes before that Thistle especially is sort of curating, of wanting it to come off, their relationship to come off a certain way. I thought that was a really fun, and also, yeah, another really scary part of the movie is just like, you know, how kind of monstrous social media can be. And I think like, not just like inauthenticity itself, but just this, like this idea of forcing other people to be fake and like, you know, that nothing is ever enough in someone's relationship. The way that Blair acts is not enough for Thistle.
Yeah.
That just like is so relatable and like just makes me want to yell at the screen in that moment of like, why are you doing this? Like, your partner's great. Or, you know, like their kind of descent at the end of the movie. But I do love like as a couple, they're very like relatable. And Blair, of course, is also very funny. Like, I love the fitness inspo that's included in it. Yeah, but I wanted to ask you more about how you decided on this theme of the influencer and how that kind of came about.
Yeah, it's something that was in there from very early days. Like, I think it might have originated from wanting to make a found footage movie, largely because of like budget constraints. We didn't receive any funding for this. You know, I've been trying to get... fighting for a feature film for many years and applying to grant after grant with no luck. So this was kind of like a push to just do it ourselves with no budget. And so the easiest way to make a film without the time and money is to go with the found footage route, because you really just need the one camera. You don't need to do a new setup every shot. You can kind of be in a more documentary style. And so I think we were thinking like, well, how do you modernize like someone who's always filming? You know, in the past, like in for the Blair Witch Project in the 90s, like you could point a, like if someone had a camcorder, they would just point it around and film everything, because it was so novel to be like, wow, I have a camcorder, I can film stuff, so I'm going to film everything. But now, like, why would you possibly be filming everything when you have the option to do it at any second? The only people you really think of who are filming everything is like influencers, if they're filming everything for the monster that is content, you know. So I think it was thinking of this film as this is a content creation exercise gone wrong and gone towards horror. And, you know, they're trying to make this redemption documentary, and that's what you're seeing. But then you're also seeing, as you say, their lives, which, you know, there's some hints that they're even going live and lying about it. At one point, Nicole, the pregnant videographer, says to Blair, "Oh, are you live right now?" And Blair says, "Oh no, I'm just shooting some behind the scenes footage." But you can see on screen, there's like 100,000 people watching and this live right now. So it's, I think that it started as a conceit of like, why are they always filming? And it became a bigger commentary than we realized it was going to be. Also on like cancel culture, because I think there's a lot of influencers and internet personalities who talk a lot about having been canceled, and yet they still have hundreds of thousands of people following them and are still making their living off of their content creation. And so I think we wanted to look at people where that's the case. Like, they clearly still have this really nice idealistic life and are doing fine, but they're like, oh no, we've been canceled. We need to fix this. We need to like, we're so like persecuted and everything, but they still have hundreds of thousands of people tuning in when they, you know, sneeze and live stream it. So I think it's kind of interesting to see how like for larger people, like people with larger followings, does cancellation really exist and what effect does it really have on them? Like certainly on within a small community context, it can have a large effect on people's lives. But if you are on the level of like a super popular influencer, like what does it really mean to be canceled right now? Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think you brought that up of what's the margin like of things that a really well-established influencer can kind of get away with before they're actually canceled.
Yeah.
And they're not able to monetize what they're doing anymore. I really liked that commentary. And felt like, yeah, a little bit, not cynical, because I feel like cynical suggests it's not the reality when we've seen time and time again that it is. I was wondering if, because I know the script was written by yourself and Nancy Webb.
Yes.
And I was wondering, did either of you have a specific influencer in mind? Maybe you don't want to name them, but was there a specific like queer influencer that you were thinking of, or like an instance in the past of someone in the public spotlight that inspired these characters?
Yeah. In our research for this, we definitely looked at a number of queer couple influencers, and I'm definitely not going to name any names, but because I certainly don't think that they're anywhere as evil as Thistle or anything, but I think there is this element of like taking something as intimate and personal and private as a romantic relationship and making your money off of displaying this like constructed reality of it has sort of like this manic, wild tendency to it. And we were just sort of seeing that in these like lesbian couple influencers, like these like couple accounts. And yeah, I think it's funny because we'd already had the idea of the baby rebrand thing. And at one point we'd started following a bunch of these accounts, and then on one of these accounts, this couple started posting just pictures of them with a baby, and we're like, they never said they're having a baby. What's going on? And like, only after you like looked really far into the image description did they say like, oh, and this is our niece, blah blah blah. But it's like they're just posting all these pictures like of themselves with this baby in this way that's very parental, but it's not their baby. And I'm like, why are you posting pictures of this baby? Why does this baby's face have to be involved in your monetized game that you're playing? You know, like,
yeah, you know. That's another thing too. Even though there is no like child, but of course pregnancy is a big theme in your movie. There's no children shown, but the number of children that I think many people have discussed being uncomfortable with, like that's a line that they draw of watching influencers monetize their children, other people's children, is another kind of like spooky theme for sure.
Yeah, it's funny. The thing that keeps happening is when we show this film to more and more people, they say, oh, I loved this one moment. It's exactly like that thing that happened with this influencer. And I've never heard of that thing they're referring to, but it's like a creepily close thing. Like there's a long scene in the movie where Thistle is trying to get a like sad reaction out of Blair, telling her, oh, your cat died, cry about it, your cat died, let's get you crying, come on, be sad, your cat died. And someone told me like, oh, this is just like that influencer who accidentally uploaded the whole uncut video of them like really like forcing their child to cry on camera about their dog being sick or dying. And like, I had never heard of that and never seen that, but we'd already like written and shot that whole thing and edited it. And then someone was like, it's just like this. And I looked at it, I'm like, it is just like that. How does this exist? Like,
wow. Yeah.
And there's been a few other instances like that where people can relate it to influencer dramas that I'd never heard of, that like, because it's all out there, they're doing this crazy stuff every day, you know?
Yeah. I mean, going back to Thistle's character, because what a fun character, but her fantastic like shellac pointed kind of talon, almost like nails.
Yes.
That are also like impeccably done. Like at one point, I know she later just puts this cream on Nicole.
Yeah.
On her pregnant belly without her consent. And it's just very clear that Nicole is very uncomfortable. But she does the thing where she clacks her nails on the glass, like very aesthetic container of cream. And there's so many moments, even when it's not like super scary or like, you know, the talking about provoking her partner to cry and like manipulating her emotions in this horrific way. But even in this light way of just like product promotion vibes, it just felt like, oh my gosh, Nancy Webb hit it on the head. Like, this is the influencer. And this thing that I feel like, even when maybe I watch an influencer and I enjoy watching them, but it's one of those things that I also like kind of make fun of, or I sort of have this dissonance of like, who does this in their everyday life?
Yeah.
But it just felt like another moment that was just so funny, because I was like, wow, like that is spot on. And just so many things that comes out of Thistle's mouth of just being like, oh my goodness, you're perfect. You've scripted everything. Like it's like we're watching the behind the scenes of an Instagram account that's been verified over and over again.
I think the really amazing thing about that is like, each scene we kind of had a description of where the characters are when the scene starts, where they are when it ends, and sort of like a handful of potential lines in the middle, but like three or four, and just sort of like, yeah, the general shape of where the scene goes and like what it serves for the movie. But all of this dialogue that's so perfectly on point is just coming out of Nancy and Andy and Naomi's mouths as the scene runs. And then of course, you know, we like refine it and develop it in further takes, but like a lot of it just is this gold that just comes out on the first take. That's just the raw intelligence and talent of these people to just know the right thing to say in the right moment. And you know, Nancy was like, I think a big thing that helped her a lot was her sort of visual transformation, that she's sort of like in drag almost compared to her usual aesthetic. Like the first time the makeup artist put her into that look and she went and looked in the mirror for the first time, she like screamed in horror at the look of what her face looked like, and with the wig and everything, it was so different. And I think that really sort of allowed her to embody someone really different and like live in that like crazy headspace. And like, honestly, when she was in that makeup, I was a bit afraid of her. Like, it was like at the end of the day when she'd take off the makeup and the wig, it'd be like, oh, Nancy's here. When did Nancy get to set? Like, I hadn't seen you all day, it felt like, because I was just like feeling like I was very carefully dealing with this scary person on set when she was in that appearance. Like,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Is Nancy wearing a wig in her Thistle?
Yeah, the wig has a name. The wig's named Amber, and there was two Ambers. They're twins, and one of them got all bloody and messed up, and the other one stayed pristine, and we still have that one. And,
okay, yeah. I love that they got named.
Yeah, they're really a character in the movie, the wig. Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's that. Yeah, like how Thistle's carrying herself and like wearing this wig and wearing this face of makeup, it did make me think a little bit of like a drag performance of this, like, I don't know if hyper femininity is appropriate, but also with these kind of bridal-esque outfits, the white lace and everything being impeccable. I mean, up until you mentioned like there's some blood and gore, I think like adds to it, and kudos to the makeup department.
We had an incredible makeup artist, Jess Cohen, who's like does like amazing like fashion makeup as well as film, and she's a genius. She really like develop that look on our first like photo tests, where one of the first things we did for the film was we did a whole photo shoot of Thistle in character so that we could print all these photos, and they're all throughout the house in the movie, that she just has like infinite photos of herself on every wall, basically.
Yes, I love that. I love the attention to detail of all those photos. I feel like it's such a fun like hint at what's to come of like, there's at least someone who's a massive narcissist in this home.
Yeah.
And how there's notably no pictures of Blair.
No.
Played by Andy.
Yeah.
Because I don't feel like we're talking about the other two actors in this movie who also do an excellent
incredible.
Job.
They're incredible.
Just because they have maybe less monstrous kind of personalities in the movie.
Yeah.
But Blair's face is not on any of the walls, it seems.
No, definitely not. No.
Just her wife.
Yeah.
But hey, I was thinking we could take a break. And do you want to introduce the song that features in part of the rebrand?
Yeah. So for the film, when we were writing it, we had this idea. It would be really funny if for this one scene, the Monster Mash comes on the radio. But of course, we couldn't afford to license the Monster Mash. So I reached out to a friend of mine from high school who has this great band called Pith. And I asked them, like, do you think you could produce a spoof of the Monster Mash for us? And Chris is the friend. And we used to, in high school, make really goofy songs together. And that was, like, something that they've always done. And they have, like, a real serious band now. But I was like, can you go back to our origins of making something really silly and dumb and make a knockoff of the Monster Mash that people will still recognize as that? And so far it's worked. There's a couple of people after the screenings that said, where did you get this like version of Monster Mash that's playing in this? And no, it's actually an original composition by Chris from Pith. And I think it'd be fun to listen to that. Yeah.
Great.
The Boneyard Boogie happens once a year. No coffee charge, the entrance fee is your fear. When the moon is full and the hour is late, all the ghouls and goblins start to gyrate. Reanimated corpses climb from their graves while a monstrous rock and roll band plays. Frankenstein's drumming, Nosferatu's on bass. It's a gruesome, ghastly happening place.
We are back. You're listening to The Get Up on CJLO 1690. My name's Hannah Beach, and I'm here with Kay Adelaide, Montreal filmmaker. We're talking about her horror dark comedy, The Rebrand. And yeah, I thought it would be fun. We haven't talked about the kind of intro piece that really adds, I feel like, to the sort of, I don't want to say meta-ness, but feeling like it really is just part of Montreal culture, because there are so many great Montreal references, including Trana Wintour,
Yeah.
I was very impressed that Trenno and Turf features in your movie. I was like, oh my goodness. Like, Kay has connections. yeah. So do you want to just mention sort of how the movie starts off?
Yeah. So this was an element that it is, as you say, quite meta because it was added afterwards. It wasn't like originally intended to be the beginning of the film. It was like, after we'd done an edit, we realized it would really help to have sort of a framing narrative for the film, a sort of extra element. And so what we came up with was sort of a true crime documentary show hosted by Trenno Wintour, who's an amazing local comedian and host. And right now she's on the Traitors Canada, which is really fun. Her run on that is amazing. That's going on right now. So we got her on board. She's a friend and she's incredible. And it was so generous of her to join in on this tiny little project and just shoot for one day with us. And she essentially is this very fabulous host of a really salacious queer true crime show that the sort of framing narrative of the film is that the footage you're watching is a documentary sort of raw footage cut together of what Nicole filmed that is being presented to you by Crime Queens, the true crime documentary series that Trenno hosts. So she intros the film and gives a whole spiel about what we're about to see and then says, bon film, and leaves it to watch the rest of the footage. And then she also has another little appearance at the end, which worked out really well. It was not planned that way. Like, we had an interview at the end that's recorded, and we were originally going to have no host for that interview. It was going to be like the questions were off camera. But then once we found out that Trenno was down to be on board, we're like, well, why don't we just shoot the opposite side of the interview and make it feel like they're in the same room together? And I think that came off well in the end.
Oh, okay. So at the end, are they not in the same room?
No, it was shot like almost a year apart.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, excellent editing. I did not notice that. Yeah, I feel like Trenno's character just adds another level to the comedy and to this idea that for the rest of the film, Blair Thistle and Nicole,
yeah.
is the,
yeah.
the actor's name, yeah. Are out of the city, right? They're sort of like cabin in the woods type vibe,
totally.
But I mean, more of like a luxury chalet, but
yes.
still.
Exactly.
Was very fun. And yeah, I know you're saying that you and Trenno are friends. And I think it was a few years ago I saw Trenno Wintour as part of a larger comedy act.
Yeah.
And she definitely stood out as just very like lightning fast and just, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if all the other comedians in the show were getting as many laughs as her. Sort of takes no prisoners, I think, yeah. in the show I saw. And I was just wondering, how much do you feel like your styles, like, do you think your style of comedy is inspired in any way? Or like, how do you, is that something that you guys share?
Yeah, I think Nancy is actually how I met Trenno. I met Trenno through Nancy because they used to host a monthly queer comedy show in town called Stand Back. And that was every month at NDQ. And or I think it was a few different places over the course of it. It ran for quite a while. And so the two of them are great friends, and they were co-hosts of the show, and they would be on stage together, and they were so hilarious together. And so when we thought to bring Trenno on, Nancy really headed writing her script for the Crime Queen segment. We collaborated, but she wrote the first draft and really sort of spearheaded it because she really knows what Trenno does best, you know, because they've performed so much together. There's this really easy understanding of Trenna's strengths and what she can do that's the absolute funniest. And so she really wrote to that. And I think it really could only happen with someone who knows the performer as well as Nancy did with Trenno, that it really worked. And then I felt it very easy to direct Trenno. I feel like we also get each other on a comedy level that made it like such a breeze to work together and just so much fun.
That's great. I also wanted to ask you about festivals.
Yeah.
So I know I or rather I want to check with you, but the rebrand premiered at the very beginning of October at the Toronto Indie Horror Fest.
Yes.
Thank you. Were you able to go in person?
I was, yeah. That was really great. I'm so happy that I could be there. It was pretty rock and roll. We had just finished shooting my partner's film, my partner Marielle Sharp, who was co-director on Don't Text Back and Monster Dyke, and we co-wrote those together. And she also produced this film, The Rebrand. So we were shooting a film of hers that we basically, and Andy was helping out on it, Andy from The Rebrand, the Andy McQueen who plays Blair. So we basically finished shooting that the night before, and then early the next morning, Andy drove us to Toronto to make it to the premiere that evening at the Toronto Indie Horror Fest, which is a really sweet, cute, like grassroots festival that's like plays the films out of the back of a really great community video store. It's like one of the only like video stores remaining in Toronto called Eyesore Cinema, and they have like a back room with like a nice projector screen going on, and it was so much fun. I got a really great reaction, and it was a very fun place to kick it off. Yeah,
that's great. Congratulations. Thanks. Very exciting that this is your debut feature film and it's getting the response that it has. I also was wondering if you could talk about the Queer Fear Film Festival.
Yeah, that was our U.S. premiere. So our world/Canada premiere was Toronto, and then our U.S. premiere was in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and is a festival called the Queer Fear Film Festival. Such an incredible festival put on by the person spearheading it is Tiffany Albright, and she's so incredible what she's doing with that festival. It's like it's a pretty small town. It's sort of like a tri-city area, the sort of foothills of North Carolina, and she's putting on this really incredible small cinema that's like a little art house cinema that's amazing, exists in this tiny town. And she brought together so many great queer filmmakers like from all over the place. It was such a great experience. I'd never actually been in person to a queer horror festival. They are not that common. We don't actually have one in Montreal, which is crazy considering the community we have here. And so it was really a beautiful experience to realize, like, you know, I like horror, I like film festivals, but it turns out there's nothing I like more than a queer horror festival. Like, it was the best festival I've been to as far as the content of every film being super queer, super scary, super fun. And the film was super well received there, and we actually won the Best Feature Film award there, which was such an honor and so exciting. And that was, yeah, quite a wild ride. It was awesome.
Congratulations. Yeah, that's also no small feat. I know when you're saying that you didn't get funding from any like grants or anything, that's something to be really proud of.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm really pleased and surprised, to be frank. Like, I wasn't expecting that kind of response so early in the run of the film. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that we might play another Halloween song now and have an ad break. But after we get back, I would love to talk to you about exposures, which I know you helped organize, and maybe just like Montreal.
Yeah.
Film scene versus your experience in Winston-Salem, I'm curious to know about. So after the break.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east, the master bedroom where the vampires feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abodes to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the match.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the match.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun. The guest included Wolfman, Dracula, and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash. Out from his coffin, Rex's voice did ring. Seemed he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
The monster mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's caught on in a flash.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. Now everything's cool, Drax a part of the band, and my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them Boris sent you.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And do my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
Montreal's ultimate comic haven, Crossover Comics, is celebrating their 12th anniversary on October 26th with a sale you won't want to miss. Absolutely everything is discounted with 15% off store-wide, buy two get one free deals on select groups of items, and free Halloween comics available while supplies last. Also, creator signings will be taking place in-store throughout the day, including Tate Bromball, writer of the new series Green Lantern, Dark. Don't miss the Crossover Comics 12th anniversary sale from October 25th to 27th, in-store at 3560 Notre-Dame West in Saint-Henri, right next to Metro Lionel Grew.
Mwahaha! I found the perfect time for evil! Mondays at noon!
Oh no you don't!
What?
That time is reserved for the angelic tracks of Indie Past.
No!
Ha! I showed him! Mondays at noon are safe with REVC. Only on CJLO 1690 AM.
Hail, traveler. Browse my fine potions, for this is my potion shop.
I am the finest potion seller in all the lands. Be wary, traveler. The roads are perilous ahead.
Mayhaps you want one of my potions for your venture.
I can offer you my finest CJLO 1690 AM potion, if you have the coin. Fare thee well, traveler.
Hello, we are back. You're listening to The Get Up on CJLO 1690. My name is Hannah, and I'm here with Kay, Montreal filmmaker, director of feature film The Rebrand. And we were just talking about your film's run at different festivals. I know it is making its way to Sweden at a festival that's starting tomorrow, the Lund Fantastic Film Festival. But I wanted to talk about exposures, which was a film festival that happened last month in Montreal. Its first year, also on a very low budget. I thought it was excellent. Your team just hit it out of the park. I wanted to ask you about your experience on that festival and kind of like maybe compare it a little bit to the Winston-Salem festival you went to, the Queer Fear Film Festival, because I know that one was horror-focused and exposures was broader. So, yeah, what did you make of the two?
Yeah, it was very, very different experiences, but both excellent. Exposures, like, you know, Iris, who runs it, has been doing so many great trans film screenings for a couple years now. And And so they really knew sort of the landscape and who would come out and the fan base. And it was really so amazingly ambitious what they were putting on, to do a 4-day festival with three features and like over 50 shorts, like very ambitious. And it totally went off without a hitch, which I was like, I was involved in organizing, I was on the programming team. And like early on, I was kind of saying like, are you sure we don't want to do like a 1-day festival to start this? But Iris was like, no, I got this. And they did have that. They were, they really made it happen. And contrasting with the festival in North Carolina, Queer Fear, it was a 1-day festival, but they still packed in so much great stuff. It was a single day in this little cinema. It was really lovely. So that one was, you know, broadly queer and everything horror and fantastic, whereas Exposures was trans specific, more than just queer and not horror. It was across lots of different genres, and they had, you know, sort of different genre based short film blocks, where all of, you know, one would be like video nasty of all sort of the underground grimy kind of genre stuff. Or another might just be about, there was one, I think it was all about queer gardening, because that's like a common theme in a lot of like trans filmmakers' work. So yeah, I think it was, that one was sort of, it was so much bigger that there was a lot more sort of like gradation of like tiny little topics that they were able to sort of turn into a whole screening of lots of films. Whereas the Queer Fear was more general, kind of just horror. Yeah,
for sure. I was wondering, like, I just wanted to bring up at least one of the features from Exposures was One Day More. One Day League, Dead Mother, Dead All is the full title. And it's a comedy out of the Philippines. I believe it was filmed in Manila.
Yeah.
And it was just such a funny, like, comedy. Also, I feel like sort of a drama.
Yeah, it definitely had dramatic elements. Yeah.
But just such an excellent ensemble film. And I guess this kind of segues me into my question of kind of accessing a lot of these films, because when I was interviewing Iris, the founder of Exposures Collective and that film festival, that came up of there's a lot of these independent movies that, of course, we're not able to find on Netflix or Prime Video. And I understand that these movies wouldn't be for free on YouTube. But just wanting to kind of ask if you had any insights on how listeners who might want to check out your movie, and they can check out the trailers on Vimeo for the rebrand. But yeah, how people can access these movies who want to see more.
Yeah, distribution, you know, it's a tricky one, because you work with sales agents and they will sell the rights to here, there, and everywhere. And, you know, Canada often gets like the short end of the stick for not getting on the better services. So I think what often happens is a film will take a while to do its festival run, and you're not allowed to have your film available for streaming anywhere while it's running in festivals. And so that kind of can mean there's a long delay before everyone gets to sort of watch it at home, which is the case at, which is the case for the rerun right now, that we're going to do our festival run for probably at least another year, and then we'll hopefully be looking into distribution, to getting it on some streaming services after that. But I think the best way to keep on top of that is to follow like the Instagram or any other social media of the director or the producers of the film, and they are going to be posting about it when new stuff happens. That's the same for me. If you want to know more about the rebrand, you can follow me on Instagram. It's k.everyday, that's k-a-y-e.everyday, and I'll be posting everything new that happens with the rebrand there, and you'll certainly know when it becomes available.
All right, thank you so much, Kay. I really enjoyed chatting with you about your filmmaking. Again, I encourage listeners to check out the trailer to the rebrand. It's on Vimeo, and hopefully in the future we'll be on streaming services.
That's
very excited for you, and excited to see what movies you produce in the future. Thank you. Yeah, and I also encourage listeners to check out exposuresmtl.com, which is a great collective showing trans filming. So I'm Hannah, and this was The Get Up.
You're listening to